Coming up on Boston Public Radio, CNN's John King joins us to talk about the young avoiding Obamacare, what he plans for the NSA, Chris Christie's challenges, and lastly, the Patriots' challenges this weekend. Then the latest on selfies. Photos are being banned at a growing list of dance clubs in New York City. We'll ask you to add to the list of places which should be camera-free. And the man behind a terrific Frontline airing tonight, The Secret State of North Korea, does what Dennis Rodman does not. He looks at what life is like for real people under Kim Jong-un.
Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane joins us with an incredible and wrenching tale about two explorers reaching the South Pole. And then MBTA General Manager Beverly Scott is in studio to take all your questions on trains, buses, and the T. All that coming up, Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hello there, Marjorie.
Hey, Jim.
So the fate of people's unemployment benefits, long-term unemployment benefits, still in the hands of congressional lawmakers. And this is my favorite. Just north of the Beltway, Chris Christie, who's giving a State of the State thing this afternoon. I assume, Marjorie, you would agree, he was very happy when there was Forkgate happening out there in Staten Island, when Bill de Blasio did the thing we talked about yesterday, and all of a sudden the discussion, hopefully not very serious, was about problems for the newly elected man of the people in New York City. At least for a day, Bridgegate was back-burnered, but there are a lot of investigations. John King from CNN, their chief national correspondent, is going to join us in a couple of minutes, and we will talk about that. And the thing I wanted to broach with you, because we've talked about this a lot on the air, including with John, which we'll broach with him in a couple of minutes, is the greatest concern the Obama people would have is when the signups finally started happening for the Affordable Care Act at a reasonable pace, which they did in December. They finally picked up. The question is who signs up, because as everybody now knows, even if you knew nothing about insurance before, if a ton of young, healthy people don't sign up to offset the costs of older, less healthy people, then the Obamacare thing is going to be a failure because obviously premiums are going to rise and that sort of thing. And in the initial report that came out in the last 24 hours, while they were aiming for 40% young people signing up at somewhere in the 25% range, which is a real problem.
Well, they don't have enough incentive. I mean, the system's a mess. The fine is not too onerous. I think it's $100 if you don't sign up the first year. So it's not that big of a deal. You know what I wonder about Obamacare? You know, we're always talking about NSA and how they got into all these elaborate, they overrode all these systems to keep everything private and stuff like that. Why weren't the NSA people doing Obamacare? Do you ever think about that?
Why wasn't Jeff Bezos doing Obamacare? I mean, there are a ton of people. But, you know, while we're waiting for John King, who apparently is delayed for a couple of minutes, let's get suggestions from listeners about what do you do to when the penalty is not huge?
Raise the fine.
What do you do to convince young people? These are, you know, the 18s to, let's say, 35s, the healthiest part of the population. Mm-hmm. Obviously, demographically, that's the case. What do you do to convince those people that they should sign up for the Affordable Care Act and not just opt for a penalty? Our number is 877-301-8970. Am I imagining this? I may have dreamt this, but was there either a commercial or something written about how mothers of young people, of 18s and 20-somethings and young 30-somethings were going to be the conduit to their children?
Well,
essentially, they were going to guilt trip their own kids into signing up for the Affordable Care. Did I dream that, or did that actually happen?
I don't know, but it's a very good idea, because as soon as your kid reaches 26 and can no longer be on your health care, then you've got to go out and you've got to either you're going to worry about you're going bankrupt if something happens to your kid, or, you know, I could see where mothers would do that. I mean, wouldn't you want your kids, once they're off your insurance, to get on their own program in case they get hit by a bus?
Yeah, of course. I mean, you're saying they should. What should motivate them is selfishness. Is that what you're saying on the part of the parents?
I think it's the parents are going to be hysterical.
You mean if their kid is uncovered?
Yeah, and before there was Obamacare, I mean, many of us know this, when your kid got out of college, that was the end of the insurance. So you either had to go, if they didn't have a job right away that provided an insurance, you had to go to COBRA.
Okay, let's take you as an example.
Yep.
You have three children
who are in the age group. The way.
No, I'm serious. If it turns out they weren't on your policies or their fathers, for example, what would you say And would they listen to you? If you sat down one-on-one or one-on-two or one-on-three with your three kids, the kids you know best in the world, and said for a whole variety of reasons, including your own health, particularly when I assume most of them are going to say, I'm going to be healthy, I don't have to worry.
The same thing I said to them about having drinking, in the, bringing their underage kids to my house.
Were you about
to
say about having sex? Or,
no, drinking. I thought you said, drinking.
Okay. Yeah, what'd you say?
Were something to happen? I mean, if I were, you know, hauled before the court as an irresponsible homeowner because my teenage children were drinking in the house, or the neighbors' teenage drinking, where kids were drinking in the house, and someone got in a car accident, or were they to hit somebody in a car and it was their fault, I'd tell them, you know what's going to happen to your mother? They're going to come take my house. They're going to come take my house. I'll be homeless on the street. You need to get insurance to prevent these things. So I think you have to guilt trip the children into
doing
it.
And would they listen to you?
Absolutely. Well, I hope they would. I hope they would. They want to put their mother out on the sidewalk. You know, I have to sit on a little couch all by myself. I mean, you have to convince your kids. But I think one of the problems is that kids themselves, you know, the old line of the young invincibles, they don't think something's going to happen to them. And they think they'll be fine. And the fine is not onerous, as I said before. So, you know,
but that's not going to change, because that's the one thing that the president can't unilaterally do. He needs
the other promise about you can stay with your health care. Maybe you can break this one too, because clearly if you are used to getting your goods online in about 2 seconds, if you get your iTunes in about 37 seconds, to spend an hour and a half trying to get on a website, I just
and then
think
not
it's
getting
happen.
What you want.
Exactly.
Well, I don't think it's just the inconvenience. I think it's sort of disgust and the invulnerability. So we want to know at 877-301-8970. Maybe you can give some advice to the administration. What should they be doing? Whether it's advertising, whether it's changing things that are changeable that probably don't need congressional approval. What do you do to improve the mix? I want to repeat. They say they need roughly 40% young people signing up for them to be able to live up to their keeping premiums under control promise, and apparently this first wave of signups was somewhere in the 25% range.
Stephen has an idea.
What's that?
He says to redesign the sign-up process so that it's an Xbox game instead of a website process. Maybe that would be the way to go. Our number is 877-301-8970. Let's start with Nicole in Mashpee. What do you think, Nicole, about getting the young invincibles to sign up?
Hey, Nicole.
Hi. Well, you know, it's funny. I read this in the newspaper this morning, and I thought the same thing that Marjorie just said. Not that they lack an incentive financially, but I don't think young people have had health problems where they rely on insurance. And so I was just telling the operator that I spoke to my younger brother yesterday, who hasn't signed up yet. He lives in Georgia. And when I spoke to him over Thanksgiving, he said, you know, haven't you watched the news? The website's a mess and all this stuff. And I said, are you crazy? You know, you're like the perfect person for this. He waits tables. He hasn't had insurance for many years off and on. And I spent about 20 minutes talking to him yesterday, and he finally got it, you know. And I think it's not really up to the administration. I mean, this whole idea is to help all of us, anyone who's in this country, you know, a citizen and wants to keep healthcare costs down. We should all be talking to anyone we know who doesn't have insurance and getting them, you know, to get interested and find out how they can sign up.
So yeah, you're saying Nicole, to appeal to their communal spirit, that this is good for America, and you have to do something that you may benefit from it directly, as you said, your brother may, but equally importantly, you should be motivated by the fact this is going to make something that is important to this country and your fellow citizens work. That was your approach.
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's America, but look around at your community, your family, your friends. I mean, this helps keep costs down for all of us, and it's not, you know, socialized universal health care. It's a way to do it sort of in the marketplace. I think the other thing that people hear Obamacare, they think it's some kind of federal insurance program. They don't realize that this is insurance that's being provided by the same companies that insure people, you know, who get it through their employer. So I think they also think it's like a handout.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about it, but I think you got a great point, Nicole. Thank you for the call. We should, instead of making them feel that mother will lose her home, maybe we should appeal to their more generous spirit to help out all their other fellow Americans. Because it's obviously true that if enough young people do not buy Obamacare, then the premiums will be even worse. We already have those millions of people in many southern states and many Republican states where the governors didn't like Obamacare, where the people that are too well, not rich, but they're not poor enough to qualify for Medicaid.
Medicaid, yeah.
But they're not affluent enough to qualify for Obamacare. They're stuck in that terrible position, too. 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970.
There's a really fine story on this whole dilemma in the New York Times. Older pool of healthcare enrollees stirs fear on costs. And I understand spin. I mean, I used to do politics myself, but all these numbers are here, and they talk – I was off by 1%. 24% of those choosing a health insurance plan are 18 to 34, which is a critical age group to make this financially workable. People 55 to 64, as the Time writes, the range just below the age at which people qualify for Medicare, represent the largest groups of sign-up, 33%. The spin that I'm talking about – I know they have to do this. Quote, but administrative officials expressed optimism that more young people would sign up in the months ahead, calling the latest enrollment numbers solid news for the healthcare law. What is solid news? And the problem with that is it undercuts the message of our prior caller, which is this is a critical time and young people have got to sort of man and woman up to make this thing a success, not to mention that it's in their own interest.
We have some very clever emailers here. Christopher just emailed and said, let them tweet it. His idea is you allow young people to sign up in 140 characters or less. And maybe they'd be more likely to take the time.
By the way,
to
if people it. Think this is making a mountain out of you know what, it is not. I mean, think about the math. Even if you know nothing about insurance, and Marjorie and I don't know much, by definition, if people aren't going to use the insurance at a fevered pitch are not going to be signing up, then and only people who are older and less healthy are signing up, by definition,
well, also,
the whole program is completely unaffordable.
There's a huge irresponsibility here, isn't there? I mean, not that we want anyone to be hit by a bus, but if you're hit by a bus without insurance, then everybody else is paying.
Well, so
for
you know,
your
the answer is if we were worried about irresponsibility, we wouldn't have a penalty rate that is so low. And the reason
it's
the penalty
ridiculous.
Rate is so low is because people who oppose the Affordable Care Act want it to fail, want people to pay the penalty instead, and there may be a self-fulfilling prophecy. Let's go to Bourne, where Jeff is on Boston Public Radio. Thanks so much for the call, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent. Thank you for the call.
I think it would be nice, but I don't think young people are going to do it for a communal basis. I might have a quick solution.
What?
That could probably be administratively passed by rulemaking. It models itself after the Social Security Medicare system. If you delay, and I know this actually in signing up for Medicare, your premiums forever are actually permanently increased. And just like young people, everyone in Social Security gets a statement of their potential actuarial benefits when they do retire, there should be a penalty that's imposed for not having insurance beforehand. The argument being that people who do not seek health care have more associated costs in the future, which is well documented for a lot of reasons. So I think if the young people, so to speak, get a letter such as that. I know it's long-term, and they think it doesn't matter to them. It'll be real dollars if you look at a premium increase for the length of their lifetime after they hit 65.
But, Jeff, why do you think that that's something that Congress would not have to get involved in? Is your contention, like Marjorie says, that the president has changed whatever he's wanted to change and delayed whatever he's wanted to change, and no one has challenged it except verbally? Are you suggesting the president – I don't know what the answer is. Does the president have the power, or should he just assert that power?
I don't know. I would suspect, as you'd probably do as a lawyer – I'm not a lawyer – that Congress might not allow that as administrative rule. But I certainly think that the president would have the ability to pass the rule, and then it could be challenged.
It's a very creative idea. The longer you wait to sign up, the more expensive it is. And the only downside, and it doesn't negate, and Jeff, thanks for the call, what you're saying, because one of the wonderful things, even if you don't like the Affordable Care Act, everybody likes the fact that there are no bans on coverage for when you have pre-existing conditions.
Right.
Because the penalties are low, there's an incentive to wait until you have a health crisis and sign up then, because they can't bar you from coverage.
The classic example is the reason people pay parking tickets reasonably on time is because the fines are like through the roof. You can start out with a $25 parking ticket, and before you know it, and I have known it on several occasions, you're up to like $200 for one.
Here's the typical phone conversation with Marjorie. Uh-huh. Do you have any idea, Jim, why I can't register my car? online? And I say, well, one of the reasons might be, I'm not saying it is, one of my reasons might be is because you haven't paid your parking tickets. And lo and behold,
yep,
more often than
correct.
Not, that has been correct.
The
Marjorie
fines
is
on
the
parking tickets.
A scofflaw.
Well, I've tried to clean up my, I have cleaned up my app. My car is registered. I just want to be clear about that, Jim. Cheryl from Worcester, what do you think about the Young Invincibles not signing up in the rates we want them to?
Well, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
I think that actually it's a lack of education on the website and the whole Obamacare thing. I think they just assumed that people would realize what went into all of this, and I think they're giving the public way, way too much credit. I think they have to go out there and talk about what the cost of illness is. Since a lot of these young people really have never had anything happen to them, or their parents have paid for it, or their parents'
right.
insurance, they don't really know that, you know, if they have to go to something, let's say they're playing soccer and they tear their ACL, that is thousands of dollars. I don't think they realize, you know, you see the doctor, that's, you know, several hundred. Then you have the surgery, that's probably 10 grand. Then you go to physical therapy.
Yep.
That's out of pocket, $40
yep.
every time, plus an extra $200 every time. They don't get that. They don't know that. They haven't been educated, and it's really not their fault. I think that they have to really get the nuts and bolts to these people and tell them that, have the costs up front so that they know it each illness, each accident, each, you know, whatever. Is going to cost.
Well, can I interrupt you to say, Cheryl, yeah. as important as it is to do education on this, public education, by the way, there's been horrible
yeah.
public education for older people, too. The vast
right.
majority of people, including those who say they support the Affordable Care Act, for the most part, can recite nothing more than we've recited. Your kid can stay on your policy till they're 26. There's a ban on denying coverage for if they're pre-existing conditions. The messenger matters, too. And while Obama is a very young president, he's still not a 20-something. He's not a millennial. And that's why my understanding was there was an effort on the part of the administration to have, for example, professional athletes, most of whom are in their 20s, delivering the message. And then there was some, I can't remember, my apologies, problem with the NFL getting involved in doing this. But it's got to be contemporaries, peers, saying exactly what you're saying, because it's a much more credible kind of message. Cheryl, thanks for the call. I've told you this example before.
What?
When I was a city councilor in Cambridge for one term.
Legendary term.
I did retire undefeated,
did
I should
retire
say.
Undefeated.
And I went to you have to go to a lot of things. I've told you this before. I was invited to something called a STARS program. Mm-hmm. I think it's STAR. I don't know if it's S or Z, whatever, at the high school. And I didn't want to go, and one of my colleagues said, you got to go, it's going to look bad. I had no interest in going. And it turned out what it was a dating violence program for teenagers. But the thing that separated from every anti-dating violence thing I'd ever seen, it was taught by people who either had committed dating violence or were the victims of dating violence as teens. Were teenagers talking to it was the most, you know, I didn't listen to the speakers as much as I watched the body language and faces and reactions of the teens who were in the audience. They were rapt. The whole it just made a world of difference that it was not some huge authority figure, but a peer. And that's who's got to deliver the message that the caller was just talking about. This is the worst public education campaign in the history of major initiatives in this country.
You know, what is the fine in Massachusetts? It's considerable.
I don't know what it
is. In Massachusetts. I mean, the point is that there was a bipartisan support when we did so-called RomneyCare in Massachusetts. The fine's big. I remember people calling when RomneyCare first went into practice and saying it was up in the thousands.
Well, they were criticizing Mitt Romney because as a Republican, they were saying he's, quote, taxing people, but he can't get that through Congress. And that is not something that he unilaterally can do.
But it shows how the dysfunction and the failure to be able to come together about anything ends up hurting things. Because, like I said, in Massachusetts, what are we, 97% or 98% of people are covered?
Well, you know why? Because the carrot, they worried if the carrot didn't work, which is all that exists now, the stick did work and the federal government doesn't have such a stick. And by the way, for those who are calling,
stick,
I don't know if people are emailing now aggravated because we're advocating for it. It's the law of the United States of America. If it's repealed at some point, it's repealed. But it is currently the law. And if it's the law, one would hope that the vast majority of people are concerned about it being implemented in a fair way, and being implemented in a fair and affordable way is dependent upon young people signing up, which they are not. Listen to these statistics, Marjorie.
What?
Remember I told you that more older people are signing up. Listen to this in certain states, West Virginia and Wisconsin, 66% of the people who signed up were 45 to 64 years old. In Maine, it's 63%. That's going to bankrupt the system even before it starts. I mean, think about it.
I know. You hit your 40s, you start falling apart.
Exactly. No, but it is, comparatively speaking, it is totally true.
Steve from Cambridge, what do you think about no young people signing up for Obamacare?
Margie, Jim, there have been a couple of assertions that have no evidence.
What are they?
One is that Obamacare is going to cut costs. We've seen from the study in Oregon that people on Medicaid run up costs as much as or more than people who are not insured.
Before you go ahead, Steve, you never heard us say it's going to cut costs. What we said this morning is, by definition, premiums are going to rise if it turns out there's not a balance in the enrollees between younger, healthier people,
Jim,
and older, less healthy. I mean, Steve, before you continue, you can cite a million studies. It is a fact that if there are not healthier people who are not seeking medical care at the rate that older people are, by definition, costs are going to go up. So you didn't hear us say premiums are going down. I'm waiting to see.
Callers who made such an assertion.
Oh, okay.
And here in Massachusetts, we've had universal care for about 4 or 5 years, I think, and premiums have gone up and costs to the state have not gone down. So it's not by definition.
By the way, Steve, small business premiums have gone down dramatically. I don't know about personal premiums, but you just happen to be factually wrong about a critical constituency which had a great problem with Romney Care at that time, were small businesses, and they've been one of the primary beneficiaries, essentially because of a cap that this governor put on them. But Steve, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. And we'll check out that Oregon study you mentioned.
I think, as people have said in Massachusetts too, it takes a long time to see these costs coming down. The other thing in Massachusetts, we have extraordinarily expensive health care.
We do.
Yes. Are we moving on? I think we're moving on.
We are. And by the way, John King was called out apparently to do a reporting thing. So it's not that CNN's John King was irresponsible, but he was otherwise engaged. We will chastise him next Tuesday at noon.
He was at the legendary Christie press conference.
Oh, he was at the press conference.
And I wanted to ask him all about that. But we'll ask him again next week when he returns with us on Tuesdays at noontime. When we come back, though, we're going to ask you, are we going on to...
We're going, we're actually going to North Korea.
Okay. That's what I thought. We're going to talk about this unbelievable Frontline documentary on North Korea. The conversation is up next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
The push to ban bullying is moving from schools to the workplace.
We're not saying that anybody who says, hey, you know, you're bullying me, that we should believe them or give that credence, but we are saying, if somebody says, hey, I'm being bullied, look at that. Take that seriously.
But critics say it's a case of good intentions gone way too far. I'm reporter Adam Riley. That story this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Providence Country Day School, where students accept the challenge to reap experience, confidence, and independence. Open class day on Wednesday, January 15th from 9 to 12. ProvidenceCountryDay.org. An American Experience, 1964. Follow the people whose actions changed the course of the country in a pivotal year. Watch 1964 from WGBH's American Experience, Tuesday at 8 on WGBH 2.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. The self-appointed basketball ambassador, Dennis Rodman, has described North Korea's Supreme Leader Kim Jong-un as a friend for life and a very good guy. Well, here's another take on the Supreme Leader's regime.
If a government is willing to kill as many people as necessary to stay in power, it usually stays in power for a very long time. There are many people who are not happy. There are many people who, in the privacy of their bedrooms, sometimes say something very, very subversive to their wives and most trusted friends. But no networks and no activities yet, because the government is brutal.
That sound is from the new Frontline documentary, Secret State of North Korea. It airs tonight at 10. Marjorie and I saw it both last night in a preview. It is really powerful. Most things you have never seen before. Joining us is the documentary's writer, director, and producer, James Jones. James, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And congratulations. I mean, it was fantastic and devastating to see what these people, especially a lot of these children, are going through. But tell people, James, how you even got to make this documentary, whom you had to depend on to get the footage you needed.
Sure. I mean, obviously, making a film about North Korea is not the most straightforward task. I mean, they let in some foreign journalists, but they're incredibly limited about what they can see. So they might see a kind of military parade, you know, the new ski resort or the kind of freak show with someone like Dennis Rodman. But actually, they're kept a long way from ordinary North Koreans. So we realized pretty early on that we needed to kind of collaborate with some ordinary North Koreans. And we found a Japanese journalist called Jiro Ishimaru, who has a network of undercover reporters living in towns around North Korea, who film secretly using hidden cameras and then smuggle their footage out across the Chinese border. And we went with Jiro to the China border and met him and received the footage and watched this new footage with him. And it was just, as you know, contained some extraordinary stuff.
And we should say, for those who are listening to this and not combing your brain, we've seen shots of Kim Jong-un and obviously, as James says, this pathetic Rodman tour with a basketball team. And we've seen the military parades and that sort of stuff. I have never seen footage like this. For example, these images of these little 8-year-old orphans
awful.
Who are tell us about them and what you were able to capture, these little kids with no families, no support, what you captured them doing, James.
I mean, so it's really heartbreaking to say, but we were kind of almost swamped with images like this of starving kids around every single market that we filmed at. These kids would gather just hoping to find scraps of food, you know, little bits of corn amongst the mud. They're in these kind of, I mean, it seems completely unreal. They're in these rags that are completely tattered, filthy. Their faces are often black with dirt and they've just been abandoned. You know, often their family was just too poor to look after them, so just told them they had to leave. So they have no support. You know, the average North Korean is too poor to give much in charity. So, I mean, it's heartbreaking to say, but I'm not even sure lots of the kids that were filmed will still be alive today. You know, their life expectancy is pretty limited.
Well, one of the most heartbreaking scenes, and we're speaking with James Jones, the writer, director, and producer of the new Frontline documentary about North Korea, was a bunch of little kids at nighttime in freezing temperatures. They were sleeping outside.
Yeah, I mean, the temperatures are way below zero. And, you know, they were huddling around a fire and, you know, the reporter just stumbled across them. But I think that kind of scene is repeated all over the country. You know, there is no kind of safety net. If you're poor, then your life is a kind of permanent struggle.
Does the average North Korean see this? We all know that we don't see until tonight at 10 o'clock, and Margie and I were lucky enough to see it last night. We don't see inside the real world of North Korea. But not only did they know, apparently most North Koreans, not terribly much about what happens beyond their borders. How much do they know, James Jones, about what happens within their borders? Did they see things like these little kids who are out on their own starving?
It's a really good question. I mean, I think, you know, they must see what's in front of their eyes. And I think, you know, outside of Pyongyang, the capital city, you know, people live in poverty and the vast majority of North Koreans don't have enough food to eat. But there's this kind of disconnect, or there has historically been a disconnect between their image of their own country and the kind of propaganda that they're fed from a very young age, telling them they live in the best country on earth, and seeing kind of state TV footage of shops overflowing with goods, and the kind of deification of their leaders. And so on the one hand, they're taught that the outside world is incredibly hostile and dangerous, and they, you know, they must kind of pay respect to their leader because this is how North Korea will survive. But on the other hand, they must recognize their own kind of crushing poverty. But what's interesting in our film is that kind of information barrier, which has kept them isolated throughout North Korea's whole existence, is starting slowly to crack because of the advance of technology and information seeping in.
Well, I want to ask you about the internet in a second, James Jones, but before I get there, there was a great scene of this department store that was stocked with beautiful goods, but there was something very unusual about the store. Tell people.
Right, so this is Pyongyang department store number one, and it's the kind of biggest, most luxurious shop in North Korea. I'm not sure what the American equivalent is, but in London we have Harrods.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so one of Giraud's reporters went into the shop, and, you know, it was pretty dramatic. You know, rows of televisions, you know, fine wine from around the country, you know, imported beer and all this stuff. And he would go to each counter and say, you know, can I have a bottle of beer? And time after time, the cashier would kind of shuffle and look at him awkwardly and say, well, actually, you know, none of this is really for sale. And very quickly it emerged that this whole shop, or many of the items in the shop, weren't for sale, and it was a sham. And it's basically, it performs part of their propaganda. You know, this shop frequently appears in the state TV propaganda showing how, you know, how advanced and successful the country is. Kim Jong-un and his father are often taken there to show them. So, you know, they probably think that that's what every North Korean shop is like. You know, they're probably quite detached from the reality.
Hey, speaking of propaganda, James, if I can, though, you mentioned a minute ago to Marjorie, you mentioned how they are taught to perceive or the United States and what a threat we are. Here's a little sound from your documentary.
The average North Korean believes a significant part of the anti-American propaganda. They believe that Americans are ready to invade. They believe that America is a threat. They believe that Americans started the Korean War in order to enslave or maybe commit a large-scale genocide in Korea. They believe it. Not all, but majority.
Well, they believe it, according to your the people who you interviewed, many of these being defectors, not just scholars. But at the same time, they love our movies, they love our television shows, or at least some do. And the perception is that the sneaking in, the smuggling in of these things into the country to a small piece of the population, I don't know how small it is, may be what helps begin to crack the stranglehold that Kim Jong-un has, correct?
Right. I mean, it's a really interesting paradox that these, you know, from a very early age, school children are told that Americans, you know, started the Korean War, all of that stuff that Andrei Lankov just set out. And, you know, state TV constantly builds up this external threat. But at the same time, with, you know, as these kind of American movies, often really bad American movies, but doesn't really matter, there's this huge appetite among young North Koreans in particular to see the movies. And it's become the kind of must-have item, you know, the DVDs and the thumb drives that have these dramas and movies.
I want to take issue with you. One of the movies was Skyfall, which I loved, the latest James Bond. I want to be clear about that, James.
But they don't generally have the internet. They have to sneak the thumb drives, as you said. There's not the internet is banned, is it not?
Yeah, I mean, the internet, there is a very small group of actually quite advanced cyber hackers who've been trained in China who have the internet, and a few members of the elite. But the average North Korean doesn't have the internet. You know, there are no bloggers. There's none of that, which makes any kind of popular uprising or movement very, very unlikely.
James, one of the things you do, and I think it's quite powerful, is you talk to a whole spectrum of defectors, people who have left that country, snuck out of the country and lived to talk about it and have dedicated at least a piece of their lives to freeing their home country. How hard is it to defect? I know China's an ally and that's one of the key borders, but you describe a family of five, which you profile a family of five focusing on the daughter, and they had a plan over a couple of years to smuggle themselves out of the country in sequential order. They had this plan, and the final one was the young daughter, who then becomes, we'll talk about her in a second. How did they do that, and how easy is it to get out of Kim Jong-un's North Korea?
It's really hard. I mean, and Kim Jong-un recognizes the kind of threat these defectors pose, so it's made it even harder and has increased the number of border guards on that border with China, which is pretty much the only way to get out. I mean, there are two ways of doing it, really. And a lot of the people who escape have family members who have already got out, who are in the South or in China, who have money. And so they can pay a broker in China. And that's kind of crucial because, you know, you can't just go straight from the north over to the south because it's, you know, the most heavily fortified border in the world. So you have to go this extraordinary kind of elaborate route, thousands of miles through Southeast Asia. So you need money, really. And so Chan Yang, the 22-year-old girl, her family were quite well off. And once the mother and father had gone, they then sent money back to a broker. But that's, you know, it's still carries a huge risk, and the border guards sometimes shoot to kill people who are trying to, you know, swim over the river to get out. So it, you know, this is not just, even though, you know, it helps to have money, you're still risking your life by doing it.
You know, one of the things, that woman we just described is part of a crew of defecting young women who do a television show called On My Way to Meet You, which some people in North Korea were able to see so they can see what world life is like in the free world. But one of the things I found really interesting is you showed a radio broadcast. I don't know if they were defectors or they were just broadcasting wherever they could, sort of radio-free North Korea, for lack of a better expression. Mm. And they were talking about allegations or something that Kim Jong-un's wife had performed in a porn flick or something. What's the story? What's the story with that?
So, as ever with North Korea, that everything is kind of swirling with rumors and speculation. So it's sometimes hard to establish the absolute truth, which is why what Giro does with his footage is so great, because it's kind of concrete and, you know, indisputable. But with the, yeah, so that story, the best sources seem to suggest that the police started to investigate whether this gang of actresses had made a porn video. And it was called something like Erotic Video of North Korea's Most Famous Actresses. And then during their investigation, it turned out that Kim Jong-un's wife may have been involved, at which point it suddenly became incredibly serious. And the story goes that the people who had made this video with his wife were executed for their role in starting the rumor. And as you say, this kind of South Korean radio were broadcasting it back into the North. And the rumor, you know, sources inside the North have told us that the rumor was spreading around like wildfire, you know, and the North Korean regime were getting more and more sensitive about it. And it's hard to know, you know, you could say that this could be South Korean propaganda wanting to unsettle the North Korean regime. But what's certainly true is that this rumor was spreading around North Korea and kind of causing the regime a lot of concern.
I'm surprised Dennis Rodman's not in the movie, actually, to tell you the truth.
How nervous must Kim Jong-un's wife be? I mean, one wrong move and it's off with her head,
I guess. Especially after what he did to his uncle, as you mentioned at the end of your film.
And absolutely. And actually, the uncle introduced Kim Jong-un to his wife. So, you know, there was a moment there when people thought, uh-oh, you know, what's going to happen with her? But they've got children together and, you know, she's been seen in public with him since then. But, you know, this is a young guy. We don't really know very much about him. You know, we have an interview in our film with someone who used to work for the CIA, and she said that when Kim Jong-un kind of became public, became known, all the CIA knew about him had been written in the New York Times 6 months earlier.
Isn't that amazing?
You know, the intelligence on North Korea is just so poor because, you know, you just don't have human assets there, and it's impossible. You know, technology isn't there. It's very hard to communicate with people. So you rely on defectors who often aren't very close to the kind of Kim regime.
We're talking with James Jones, the writer, director, and producer of the Frontline documentary Secret State of North Korea, which is going to be on tonight at 10. Check your local listings. One of our colleagues just called, James, to ask about the North Korean Underground Railroad. What's the deal with that?
I don't actually know very much about the Underground Railroad, I have to say. Okay. So I'm probably not the best person to ask.
So the best way, essentially what you're saying, the best way to get out of North Korea, if you're lucky enough to have the money, is to buy your way out. That holds virtually the only hope, yes?
Yeah, if you can bribe the border guards, both on the North Korean side and the Chinese side, and then have a broker take you, you know, down to Thailand or wherever, where you can get asylum and be flown to South Korea, that's pretty much your best bet. But, I mean, defecting is a serious thing, and if you're caught, you know, we feature a few cases where people are accused of being a spy, sent to a political prison camp, and, you know, sometimes their whole family will join them there. I mean, you know, these, as ever with North Korea, the punishments are incredibly severe.
Do you say, speaking of political prisoners, do you not say at the top of this documentary, I was relatively sleepy when I was watching this, so my apologies, not because of the documentary. It was late at night last night.
I won't take that personally.
You shouldn't at all. Did I hear correctly that some informed sources suggest that as much as 1% of the North Korean population is in prison for political reasons? Did I get that number right?
That's
or am
right.
I wrong? 1%?
That's right.
It's huge.
It's 200,000. Yeah, I mean, it's extraordinary. Some of these prison camps are not like prisons that you or I know. I mean, one of them is three times the size of Washington, D.C. These are whole towns, and there's just, you know, tens of thousands in each camp. And the conditions are just appalling. And people starve to death regularly. The other prisoners are forced to dig them shallow graves. You know, it's one thing that our undercover footage obviously can't show because, you know, it's just too difficult to film there, and kind of asking any of the reporters to try and get that would be irresponsible.
You know, James, I know this happened after you finished your terrific documentary, as Marjorie says, which airs tonight on PBS, GBH, PBS, at 10 o'clock. But unlike what the average North Korean will get to see about real life, which is virtually nothing, I'm assuming that virtually all of them got to see Dennis Rodman singing Happy Birthday to Kim Jong-un. What impact, what does that do? How does that help him strengthen his stranglehold on his own people? How does Rodman become a pawn of Kim Jong-un?
Right. I mean, it's debatable how much impact he would have, but certainly he was put on the front page of the North Korean state national newspaper. And so it was a propaganda coup to have someone they could present as an American superstar coming over and kind of subordinating himself to Kim Jong-un, singing happy birthday, you know, creeping to him, donating him this basketball game as a birthday present. You know, that's all useful for Kim Jong-un, who's aware that he needs to seem more kind of modern and progressive to a kind of more cynical population. So, you know, Dennis Rodman, I mean, I guess he's naive if we're being generous, but he's certainly, you know, playing to the tune of this brutal dictator who, you know, his list of crimes is, you know, extensive. So I think Dennis Rodman needs to get better advice, really.
Do you know who won the game? Because you'd also think to yourself, if Dennis Rodman clobbered the North Koreans.
No, they joined for in the second half, actually. They mixed the North Korean team as an actor.
Otherwise, he might wind up in the gulag as well. James, toward the end of your documentary, you do have a little bit of hope about how the subversive information and exchange in North Korea may play out, and that perhaps the leaders, Kim Jong-un's hold is not as tight as everybody thinks. Let's hear a bit of that piece.
These changes cannot be stopped. Marketization, information flows, all of these kind of trends lead to a transformation one way or another of North Korea. The system as it stands is just unsustainable.
Kim Jong-un faces the dictator's dilemma, which is they need to open up to survive. But the process of opening up could lead to the collapse of the regime, not the state, but of the regime. And so this is a dilemma that he faces. It's one his father faced. It's one his grandfather faced.
So, James, is there some hope here that this change might come sooner rather than decades from now?
I mean, I certainly think that you're right. There is a hopeful element to the film, and something has changed. The mindset of North Koreans is changing with the influx of information about the outside world, you know, with the advance of technology. The North Koreans are not as obedient and they're certainly not brainwashed, but certainly not as obedient as they were to Kim Jong-un's father and grandfather. So there is some hope there, and I think all the experts we spoke to would agree that something here is happening. But there's a big jump from people being more aware and more cynical to overthrowing Kim Jong-un's regime. And, I mean, the biggest stumbling block is the security apparatus.
You know, but
if you think you're...
I'm sorry, James. Sorry. Finish your thought. My apologies.
Well, I was just going to say, if you are grumbling privately and you want to kind of organize some kind of opposition, you risk not only your own safety, but your whole family. And there are very few people who are brave enough to do that.
When you say brave enough, some of my favorite pieces of this documentary come in this area when they are discussing whether there's a North, they don't call this, whether there's a North Korean spring in the offing. Mm. You have some images of women who are berating law enforcement officials, I don't know, security guards, whatever they are, part of the government, pushing them in one case. This woman who's what is set up a private enterprise, which I guess is illegal and punishable, she's essentially started a private bus company where she drives people around on the back of a truck. She gets into it with a security person. And as I'm watching, I'm saying, I hope Jones is not going to allow this woman to be shot on screen. And not only is she not shot, she takes on this guy, basically gives him the finger, not literally, but figuratively, gets back and drives her bus away. I mean, do these women, are they individuals just standing up, or are they part of something? Where does the strength come from and the fearlessness? What's that about?
Yeah, I mean, the first time I saw that footage, I mean, my breath was taken away. And, you know, given what we know about North Korea and how oppressive it is and the punishments that people risk. It was just incredibly uplifting and inspiring to see these women being so bold. As you say, this soldier comes to tell her off, and she literally chases him off down the street.
I loved it.
Slapping him on the back.
It's great.
You know, calling him every name under the sun. And it's great, particularly watching the film. You know, you've seen 2/3 of the film, and you've heard the most appalling stories of the, you know, brutal treatment of the regime and the security forces. So to see these brave women standing up for themselves is very cathartic. I mean, I think the crucial point here is that, you know, with the spread of markets and the new information, people are more bold and more willing to challenge authority, but that's only when it's not political. You know, people would still be very, very cautious of doing anything to do with Kim Jong-un and the regime. You know, so when there's a kind of junior soldier telling you off, that's one thing. But if there's something more substantial that relates to the regime, I think people would be far too afraid.
Well, James Jones, congratulations on terrific working.
Terrific.
Congratulations to the Japanese journalist who is literally
Absolutely.
Risking his life to get the information out of North Korea. And James, thank you for joining
us. Pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
James Jones is the writer, director, and producer of the new Frontline documentary, Secret State of North Korea. It is going to be on tonight at 10 o'clock. Double-check your local PBS listings to make sure it's on at 10 o'clock where you live. Okay, when we come back, we're going to go to a little bit less pressing topic.
Make this transition, Marjorie. I'm dying to hear how you do this.
Well, it's a small little annoyance, but it's fun to talk about. We're going to ask you if selfies and Instagram should be banned. A club in Brooklyn, actually several, are shutting down Shutterbugs. Would you like to see that ban take off in dance clubs, in nightclubs, in restaurants, wherever you happen to be? That's next on Boston Public Radio.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting looks at government accountability issues. It looks at environmental issues, criminal justice issues.
As well as simply in-depth stories telling people something they don't really know about.
And we are going to give you the tools and the information to decide whether you think this is the way our government should be working, this is the way people in our community should be treated.
The New England Center for Investigative Reporting, now a partner with WGBH News.
WGBH programs exist because of you and Samets Blackstone Associates for more than 30 years helping businesses and nonprofits tell their stories and build relationships through integrated brand strategy, design, and digital media. On the web at sametz.com. And the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, striving to provide patients with expert cancer care, innovative services, and treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browning and Marjorie Egan. As Marjorie said, from the brutal streets of North Korea to the not-so-mean streets of Brooklyn, New York.
Yeah.
There's a story in the New York Times about a dance club in Brooklyn. As Marjorie said, there are a bunch of other clubs, too, that have a no-photo policy, and it's one they enforce seriously. The reasoning behind it is not so much about protecting the privacy of clubgoers, which is actually what I care about. It's more about creating an environment that isn't buzzing with paparazzi machinery. So is this a practice you'd like to see enforced in other venues? I would. Would you like it if concert halls and bars, places of worship, museums, restaurants had a no-photo policy? Or are you one of those fatalists who say this is the kind of technology that's so much of a part of our culture that it really is not enforceable and wouldn't make a difference? Our number is 877-301-8970. And let me tell you right now, I'm so glad this piece was written, even though it's only about dance clubs. I don't care about the paparazzi. It's not as much an issue in Massachusetts as it is in dance clubs in New York City.
Down the street?
But the notion that somebody can invade your privacy in one of two ways. I don't mean a public place outside, but I mean an enclosed place. Either taking pictures of themselves or taking pictures of themselves in which you are in the background when you're just out relaxing, watching a movie, going to a museum. I hate it. And my assumption is the presumption should be, the rebuttable presumption is, there are no cameras and no photos to be taken anywhere in an enclosed place where the public can go. And if they want to make an exception to that rule, then they should post it, let us know that you're entering a place where your picture could be taken. And excuse me. And it's not because I'm slinking around, as you always suggest.
No, you're not slinking, it's just, Jim. You're slithering.
I hate slithering. My apologies.
It's okay.
I hate this notion that everything and everyone is being photographed and no one's being asked. Our number is 877-301-8970. Would you like this policy implemented in places that you frequent, whether it's the neighborhood restaurant, it's the bar you go to, it's the play, it's the lobby of the play you're going to see?
Excuse me. I mean, people with young kids, or even if, you know, you don't have young kids, if you're, I mean, I went to a college event that one of my daughters was involved in, and it's amazing how many people are videotaping the whole thing. Now they're not using video cameras, they're using their iPads, whatever they are. I mean, they're taping the whole thing, and I'm thinking,
well, that's a problem, though. I mean, what do you, when your kid's performing, you do want to get video or photos of your, what do you do there?
I think you don't get video or photos. You watch your kid perform.
As and opposed then maybe to
you
photo.
I mean, you pay attention to what they're actually doing on stage. Instead, I mean, if you want to take a picture afterwards or something, but you're there to watch the performance, not to preserve the performance so that we can all look at the performance later on. And I often wonder, what do these people do? Okay, we all went to see the play, and Grandma was there, and the aunts were there, and it was very good. It lasted for an hour and a half, and like most school plays, most of it was pretty bad. And then you go home, and you watch it again.
No, you never watch it, of course not.
Exactly.
But can I tell you, yours is that's a tougher case. I wouldn't have picked that one, frankly. How about you go to a restaurant?
Bam.
I have
parents with their video cameras and their iPads.
I know
iPads.
A person who has a kid. I shall not say who he is.
Uh-huh.
Happens to be me. whose kid is photographed every meal she's ever eaten. And she takes a picture of the meal. It's only the plate itself. And then she texts it or tweets it out to her friends. I have no idea why they're interested.
They all do it.
I don't like that she does it. And not because I find it absurd, because everybody finds art in different things, and she finds art in whatever her meals are. I don't want to be sitting at the next table when somebody's taking a photograph.
Neither do I.
I know I'm almost anal about it. I just don't like it. It's an invasion of people's privacy that without
also,
a notion. And by the way, you know what they have? You know how they used to have no smoking areas before they banned smoking, thankfully? They should have no photo areas. If they can't, and by the way, they could do that at that school play you're talking about. You want to take pictures of your kid? Sit on the right side of the audience. You want to be in a no photo area where you can actually watch the performance. You don't end up in a photograph or a video yourself. Then you sit on the left side. There should be no photo zones.
One of my kids does this thing too with the meals, and I say to her, why does anybody care what your like hors d'oeuvre was at wherever it was that you went to dinner with your friends? Why does anybody care? But they do it. It's like a big thing now, taking little pictures of their little plates when they arrive on their table. There's something a little self-absorbed about it.
That's my cell phone. Don't call that. It's 877-301-8970. Should we all make like this, some of these dance clubs in New York City? And maybe the technology is so beyond us, and maybe it's so much a part of who we are now that we take a picture of absolutely everything. As Marjorie says, you don't experience anything. You take a picture of what it is that you should be experiencing, but instead are just photographing. But I would love it. And by the way, let me say this one additional thing before we get to the calls. If I was choosing between two restaurants or two plays or two concerts, both of which I had equal interest in, and I knew for a fact that one of them did not allow photographs to be taken, that's where I'd go. I just like, again, 20 years ago when they allowed smoking in restaurants and then they moved to no smoking zones, which didn't mean anything because the smoke blew over anyway, a no photo zone would be perfectly fine with me. Let's go to Liz. You are first on Boston Public Radio on with Jim and Marjorie. Hi there, Liz.
Hi, Jim. Love listening to you every day.
Well, thank you. Thank you. We appreciate it.
I just wanted to give you something for your consideration. If we needed everybody's permission to take their picture, we wouldn't be able to do the documentary about North Korea.
Well, that's an unfortunate phone call, Liz. That is
well,
a very fine point.
There's a bigger purpose. There's a bigger purpose there, Liz, though, than taking the picture of your hors d'oeuvre at the restaurant you're at, wouldn't you say?
Well, think about if there are inappropriate or illegal activities going on in a nightclub and there's no way to prove it.
Well, by the way, in this piece in the New York Times, they talk about illegal activity, like drugs in particular, and that's the concern of some people. And in deference to James Jones, who made this wonderful thing that I hope you're going to watch at 10 o'clock tonight on the real streets of North Korea, not the ones that Kim Jong-un travels, they blocked out faces. They were very careful I know you're half kidding, to protect the privacy of people involved. And most of the photographs, video they took were in public places, not in enclosed environments. Liz, thank you for your kind words, and thank you very much for the calls. Callie Crossley, who would know, our colleague, just called one of our producers and says there are restaurants in Boston now that do not allow photos. I was unaware of that, but that makes me
Callie
really happy.
On
I'm going to get
her
there.
Game today between this
She's
and North Korea. She's paying close attention. Maybe she could send us back the names of the restaurants.
It's good one of us is. You know what I mean? No, I'm serious. You haven't answered. You haven't responded to what I said before. Not that you had to. If you had a choice, if you could go to a place. You're choosing between two relatively equal restaurants in your mind, mm-hmm. and one had a no photo thing, and you're not slinking around like I apparently am, according to you.
Jim, it's
what?
Not slinking.
What is it?
It's slithering.
Slithering. You're not slithering around. Would you not go to the restaurant that doesn't allow people to pull out their phones and not only forget making calls, but allow people to take photographs?
I am rather hostile toward the whole photo experience in general. I'm not sure it's because I'm lousy at taking pictures myself, or I always forget my camera, or looking optimistically. I'm living mindfully in the moment, Jim.
You know, speak on a very serious note, and mm-hmm. it's a horrible thing to mention, but it's relevant. You hear about the story in the last 24 hours in Florida. This guy's in the movie theater. He's allegedly texting his 3-year-old kid, and the guy behind him asks him to stop texting. He doesn't. He turns around and says something like, "I'm texting my 3-year-old kid," shoots him and kills him. Shoots. I know you're making that expression in your face. That was my reaction. Shot dead in a movie theater.
That is unbelievable.
It is unbelievable.
But you know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago where movie theaters are talking about having separate sections in the theater for texters to sit at. So if you want to text all during the movie, you just can't bear it. You could sit in row, 22 through 25. You can all text together.
Hey, by the way, someone in the peanut gallery in the studio reminded me that the shooter is a retired cop, by the way, in Florida. It's a horrible, horrible story. Let's go to Marblehead, where Jenny is on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about off the dance clubs in New York City banning photos, selfies and all others, whether or not we should extend the ban well beyond just those kind of places. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. So to some degree, I think we should extend the ban because I'm 17. So there are a lot of my peers I'm still in high school that are taking pictures of just like museum exhibits that we might be at, or like concerts, and I think that detracts from what we're observing.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. I think you're. I can't believe it. At 17, Samantha, you think that because I'm totally
Jenny.
With you. Oh, it's Jenny. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
But Jenny, you're an outlier. Most of your friends don't feel the same way you do. They live through their cameras, don't they?
I don't want to make that generalization because I think a lot of teens are find cell phone use to the extent that it's used a little obnoxious.
Good.
Yeah.
Well, spread the word to their parents, Jenny. I think that's the next step from the teenager who shows some wisdom to a parent. Jenny, thank you for your call. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, that's right. And sorry, I called you Samantha instead of Jenny. Jenny. Anne in Cambridge. What do you think, Anne?
Hi there.
Hi.
I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
Glad thank you.
It on. And I'm probably about the same age as the two of you.
Yeah.
Kids in college and one out. But
right
my husband
and I, ready to expire yeah. any minute. Is that what you're talking about?
We're only 21, actually.
Ahead,
walking slowly on my knees hurts.
Cut in.
But the iPhone still works. My husband and I go out to dinner a lot, and we do take pictures. He loves food. He's very into food. He takes pictures of his food. We don't use a flash. He jokes that he's ashamed when he does it. Sometimes the waiter takes our picture. We love going out. We love talking to the people who are waiting on us, engaging with them. I think it's less annoying than, what I told your screener, the drunk woman at the next table who is talking very loudly about her divorce.
Well, I would agree with that.
Too. But Anne, why does your husband take the pictures of the food so we can look at them later on? Or I don't get it.
We share them on Facebook. I mean, we have actually texted with our daughter during a dinner when we were traveling saying, "You wouldn't believe this place. Here's a picture of our food. She's in another state." And it's almost like we're having a conversation with her and sharing it with her. We're not, texting is quieter than our conversation. I don't know what the problem is. If people are standing on their chairs, if they're including you in the photograph, And if I'm taking a picture of my plate, unless your face is on my plate, which it should not be,
that is a good point. Now, Anne, before we let you go, to show what kind of hypocrite I am, since I live in Cambridge, if your husband could please text me photographs of food at his favorite restaurants, I would much appreciate it. Anne, thank you. What's that?
I'd be happy to.
I knew you would.
Bye-bye.
Anne, thank you much for the call.
Thank you very much for the call.
Let's take one more.
Okay, Michelle in the car. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, dear.
Hi.
Thanks. It's funny because I'm pretty much along the lines with you, Jim, as far as I think I don't like it. And I guess to me, you know, Anne sounded so reasonable, and it seems like if people were like that, you know,
great point,
you know, respectful of others and all of that. But at the same time, I just don't get all of that, because when I see someone else's picture of food on Facebook, I don't really care.
Exactly.
You know,
exactly.
It's like, why do I care what you're eating? You know, you can call me, tell me, invite me to go to that restaurant with you. I think part of what we do, it's like, it's all about just kind of putting out there what we do and recording it, as opposed to experiencing it.
Yeah, but can I tell you, but I agree with that, and that's Marjorie's primary point. You essentially photograph, you have no idea what it is you are at. All you know is that you have a picture of it. But, you know, if that family, and Anne did sound far too reasonable for this discussion.
Right.
If they went to a restaurant and asked for a private room where a husband photographed to his heart's content every course of their meal, I'm fine. I just don't like it when I'm sitting at the next table, even if, and it's her, you're right, her husband sounds like a totally responsible soul, even if the camera or the phone is pointed at the food as opposed to them with me in the background, I still don't, it seems like an invasive kind of thing. And so, Michelle, I am totally with you, but we're fighting a tough battle. Michelle, thanks so much for the call.
It's where we're heading. It's where we're heading. We now have to engage with our children that are in other states when we're eating dinner with our spouses. And pretty soon we're going to be like that guy and her. We're all going to be carrying on with
our
computers.
Having an affair with our operating system.
That's right. It's just right around the corner. Anyway, when we come back, well, you probably wouldn't fight as much with the computer as you do with your spouse. In any case, when we come back, we're going to be joined by Harvard Business School's Nancy Kane for Open Mic. What the original Amazing Race can teach us about leadership is next on 89.7. You're not going to want to miss this.
Genius of established big companies breeding the next innovators?
Corporate innovation is when you think really big about a problem that's adjacent to your space. Address that problem in a way that's good for the customers and good for...
Moy believes the old big Fortune 500 may be the source of the next big thing in business. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2 here on 89.7 WGBH.
This program is made possible thanks to you and the Massachusetts Teachers Association, reminding you that learning doesn't just happen in the classroom. It happens all day, every day. Working together, parents and teachers can make this a successful school year for every child in Massachusetts. And Celebrity Series of Boston, presenting bass baritone Gerald Finley performing Schubert's Winterreise with pianist Julius Drake on Friday, February 7th at NEC's Jordan Hall. You can learn more at celebrityseries.org.
By the way, we're just sitting here talking with one of our colleagues. Nancy says, okay, guys, we've got to get going. Nancy is the guest, not the host. But in any case, speaking of her, welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Joining us, as she does every Tuesday for Open Mic, is Nancy Kane. As you know, Nancy's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book, which is totally relevant today, is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Today, we're going to learn leadership lessons from some other Antarctic explorers, Amundsen and Scott. Nancy, it's great to see you.
It's great to be here.
I read the story this morning, and I was just devastated by the contrast in one guy's great success and one guy's total tragedy. So please tell people, especially the part about the dogs.
Well, before you tell people the story, why are we even talking about the story? What's the relevance of the story of these explorers to the rest of us in 2014?
The relevance is that there are very few other classrooms in which you can stack up two leaders, two teams, trying to do something as interesting and high stakes and at the time as important as the race for the South Pole in late 1911, early 1912. And so we have this great, almost like textbook, except that it's real, and as Kissinger once said, has the added advantage of being true, and it's an astounding story. I mean, we'd be interested in this story even without the two leaders. But you add the two leaders in, they're so different. The outcomes are so different. One triumphant, one absolutely tragic. And then the very interesting legacy these two men have had, the victor, the Norwegian explorer, Roald Amundsen, who got to the pole first, lost in the mists of ignominy and history for many, many years and resurrected in the last 20 years, and a guy named Robert Falcon Scott, a British explorer who died tragically and unnecessarily, and his four teammates on the way back from the pole, kind of really deified for generation after generation in England. I mean, I was married to an Englishman, and he used to make a joke of a gentleman named Titus Oates, who's one of his crew members, who walks out of the tent one night starving.
One of Scott's team members
who they're on the way back. They're starving. They're wounded. They're racing for their lives to get to food depots. Oates knows he can't make it. He knows they can't carry him. They're too weak. And so he walks out of his tent and says, I'm going out now, supposedly. I may be some time. So my ex-husband used to always say when he took the garbage out, I'm going out. I may be some time. Right? Which in England was so well known. That story, the whole story of Scott and this martyr's death was so well known that you could make jokes about it.
Wait a minute. So fascinating.
The hero disappears and the failed leader becomes a god. And only, as I said, in 20 years have we kind of got the story right and started to learn the right lessons.
But, so I just want to be clear. He was sacrificing himself.
He was sacrificing himself because he thought, yes. I'm holding these guys up.
Okay.
Because his leg was gammy.
Give us the contrast in why the Norwegian. And by the way, before we get to the contrast, why was the Norwegian not hailed as a great leader? Why was he living in infamy all these years?
Two reasons, I think. One, because he was an understated person, and he came from a country much less powerful at the time than the British Empire.
Okay.
And second, because when Scott and his teammates' bodies were found, this is 7 or 8 months later after they died, about 10 miles from their closest food depot. I'll come to the details in a second. And the news was eventually gotten back to London and broadcast or telegraphed around the world. Amundsen said right then, the guy's going to be a hero. He's going to be martyred, and no one is ever going to remember what I did. Shackleton, by the way, said the same thing, because Shackleton was alive at that time. And so the British Empire and the astounding nature of the race for the South Pole, right, became a kind of glorified failure in which no one dissected in detail, or most people didn't dissect in detail, what actually caused those men to die.
Okay, so let's go
so
back 100
years.
So
that gets to the story.
Let's go to the beginning.
Okay.
100 years ago, nobody has made it to the South Pole. Take it from there.
Okay, 100 years ago, nobody's made it to the South Pole. Roald Amundsen, an Arctic explorer, someone experienced in the area of the North Pole, decides he's going to take his men and experienced dogs, sled dogs, and they're all experienced skiers, that matters. He's going to take them to the South Pole. He doesn't tell them, by the way, until they're well out of port from Norway. He tells them, no, we're not going to the North Pole, which was the ostensible reason. We're going to the South Pole. And they head south. And Scott had been long planning this expedition, Robert Falcon Scott. He had made a failed expedition with Shackleton about 9 years before, failed expedition that didn't get very far, in which the men almost died there too. And he's going back for his race. He has a lot of very heavy people backing him, most notably the Royal Geographic Society. And he is going without the men being able, most of them, to ski at all, with sled dogs that they're not sure they're going to use and that they don't really have much training with, dogs or men, with ponies that he's never really tested in the harsh conditions of the Antarctic winter or summer. They'll travel in the summer. Remember, that's the opposite of our summer because it's the Southern Hemisphere. But ponies aren't tested. And he's got some motor sledges. They look like motorized, plows that he's thinking about trying. But those two are untested. So how we're going to get from base camp, by the way, they're sailing from the, if you will, from the southern part
from the Australian side, excuse me, from the Australian side, if you will, of the South Pole rather than the South American side. And they make their base camp on the Ross Sea, which is the kind of most northern part of the Antarctic continent. Both men arrive roughly the same time, a few weeks apart. Both men and their men set up camps just across the ice shelf. They can't hear each other, right, like the opposing armies in Henry V. But they are close, and they know they're close. And so from the beginning, they know there's a rivalry. They're all keeping diaries, which is why Roland Hunford, the great polar historian who's written about this so memorably, don't walk, don't pass go, don't collect $200, run and get the last place on Earth, which is Hunford's book about this. You will not be able to put it down. It'll be the best book you read in 2014. And so we have this great story stacked up week by week of the two parties. So here's the story in a nutshell. Amundsen, they all arrive about a year before they're going to leave, less than a year. They arrive at the beginning of winter. They're going to winter, prepare, and then set off in the summer, which is our fall. And Amundsen spends the entire winter nailing everything down. They test the shoes. They test them. They go out and they don't like them. They take them apart. Basically, the snowshoes. They bring them back. They test the sledges. They pack. He sets one person to pack, and they pack and unpack and pack and unpack the sledges so that there is no millimeter of space. They even design, right, boxes that don't actually have to be unlashed from the leather lashings on the sledges, so they can open and eat quickly and get the camp set up after a cold day's marching without having to unlash the sledges, because he recognizes that every ounce of wasted energy is calories and emotional energy and physical energy dissipated. So it's all like that. We test the dogs, right? We recarve the sled, the skis, to get the right diameter, the right length, the right curvature over and over and over again. He is dogged. We test the food rations. We don't take any coffee. He doesn't want the men overstimulated. There's chocolate in very careful rations. There's a well-designed balance bar, so to speak, like the kind Shackleton will use about 6 years later. Nothing is left to chance. The dogs are fed and allowed to have sex and play because he wants them ready, fat and happy and ready to make the dash for the pole. It's going to be about 700 miles, folks, up and back, 1,400. And they set off. They set off in early in the fall when the temperatures are low. Now, remember, the temperature in the summer at a high is like about 10 or 15 degrees Fahrenheit and can drop as low as 50 degrees Fahrenheit.
In the summer.
Can drop as low as 50. They set out. They immediately hit a blizzard.
Below.
I'm sorry.
I just want to be
so
clear.
We got a 65 degree range, right? Say 15 above to 50 below, right? With lots of days below zero, right? So, and we designed the harnesses so that the dogs fan out. This is not what you picture when you picture sled dogs, right? Six on each side lined up, because it turns out the dogs work better if they can see, right, in a very careful line, who will basically be like the ringleader, a man skiing ahead of the dogs.
Okay.
He actually turns out to be the one that the dogs most respect, like the dog trainer. So they design everything. And they start off, and it's a disaster. A blizzard hits. The shoes are not right. He realizes the packing harnesses are too cumbersome to undo in the snow and the wind and the biting sleet and so they kind of whimper back to camp and regroup and fix everything that went wrong. Shoes, skis, lashings, harnesses, everything. The dogs, he realizes, are also out of shape because they've had whatever, 8 months, you know, having sex and lying around, a whole nine yards. Not too shabby.
They're
right?
Happy, eating, but they're out of
were
shape.
Were there puppies? Were there puppies at this point?
Oh, they had puppies, but they take only the best dogs. They've had plenty of time to figure out who are the best dogs.
Okay.
The agreement with the men at the beginning, he has a very unique combination. So leadership lesson number one is Amundsen understands you can be both autocratic and democratic. They're like levers, right, or gears, you know, stops on your gear shift. And so... He has a plan. He's told them what it is. They have dates in mind. They know where they're going. And at the same time, each of the major kind of, if you will, precepts or initiatives behind that plan, he discusses with the men and obtains their agreement. So one of the first and important precepts is we will eat the dogs as we use up weight in food and fuel. By the way, he's
dogs.
So careful about fuel that his paraffin tins, the way he saw, the paraffin's going to heat everything. It's going to heat the tent. It's going to heat the food. It's going to melt the water for snow, which is so critical because these guys get really dehydrated. And he's got these hermetically sealed tins because all the explorers north and south have discovered that paraffin creeps. It evaporates in very cold temperatures. So he's thought of it. So they've agreed they'll eat the dogs as needed as they go along. And they, in fact, have pictured about where, they've planned about where at the base of the trans.
They're going to shoot them.
And one of the reasons they're doing that is because that means they can carry fewer provisions because their meat is the dog.
Exactly. And the dogs will eat dog. They'll all eat dog meat. Fine. And they all know it. And they have to know it in advance because that's emotionally very difficult for the guys.
They're not going to eat your dog, Mark.
Right? It's very difficult. And so they set off, and it just goes like clockwork. Right, and he's very, very careful about their energy. Lesson number two is feed and water your team and manage their energy. So there's plenty of food. We travel X speed, and then we rest. It's very, very important to him that everyone get plenty of rest.
16 hours.
Well, by the time they're coming back, they have lightweights coming back.
Yeah.
They're so far ahead of schedule that he's making them stay in their tent, making the dogs lie down. Right. They even, by the way, this is how careful he is. When they stop at night, they build little like walls of snow around their tent so the dogs won't pee on the tent. It's so smart. And it's all down to a routine. So as they're coming home, they get back so quickly that he's making them rest because he doesn't want to leave anything to chance. One of the most interesting things, and I'll mention two other lessons, and we'll turn the page to Scott. One other very interesting thing is he's very careful to cache lots and lots of food. So during the winter, and the months leading into the worst winter weather, they sent advance teams ahead, including Amundsen and the dogs, to test things, but also to cache food, right, to lay it down in depots, effectively. And then he would lay a mile across black flags at like 20 feet across.
A mile.
So that they couldn't miss it coming home. Right, because think about it. Your tracks are going to be covered. You're driving. You don't have the same points of orientation on the Antarctic plain, on the Beardmore Glacier, right across those mountains that you do in, say, Fresh Pond, going around the pond, walking your dog. So he lays these astounding markers.
Mile wide.
A mile across. Right, so
wow.
They can't miss it. So if they stumble and get off, they still are near their food. And he caches lots and lots of depots in the approximately 600 miles coming north from the Transantarctic Mountains, which are about 200 miles north of the pole, to base camp, the 500 miles. He has made 7 depots. Scott, by contrast, partly because he's not in control of his men. He's not sure what he wants to do, only lays 2.
How long was the total time that Amundsen and his people were out there before they returned to the base?
So let's see. They leave in early November. They're at the pole December 14th. They spend 2 days making marks, leaving flags, notes to Scott, everything. And they're back January 26th. So make it, 2 months, 3 weeks, something like that, a little less.
And it put this in context. While Amundsen is doing what he's doing, Scott, who hopes to be the first there as well in this competition, for lack of a better expression, because it's 100 years ago, has no idea, correct, that Amundsen has made it there.
Not till they get there. And
right,
entry in his diary that night when they get there, they stumble into the pole in mid-January. So about almost a month after, a little less than a month. After the Norwegians, he says, "Oh my God!" I mean, he's so depressed. He says, "God, this is a fearful, awful, hateful place." Right, and to be here,
see the Norwegian flag,
and
right?
To be here and not have made it in terms of priority. I hope to God we can get back. So Scott, by contrast, from the very beginning, Scott isn't quite sure what his plan is. Are we there to collect historical samples? Are we there to beat Amundsen? Are we there to get to the pole first? Are we there to kind of, sing praises for God, king, and country? It's not quite clear, and he's never very clear with his men, whereas Amundsen's like, we're going to be first to the pole, and we're going to beat Scott whatever it takes. It's a race. So the men always regarded it as a ski race to the pole and back. It's not clear, and Scott's not very clear all through that long winter. While they're, getting ready, and there's much less preparation and much less activity, right, at base camp and Scott's camp, right? There's lots of, they have a little newsletter they write, they play a lot of games, they read books, they recite poetry. There's much less testing of the shoes, testing of the dogs, testing of the sledges, testing of the ponies. And there is a lot of disagreement among the men, because Scott has never announces his orders in advance about how far they should go south laying depots on these, kind of advance parties.
So much less buy-in to compare to the Amundsen
buy-in
experience.
And
you
much less
about
clarity from the leader. So leadership lesson number four is you got to be clear about your objective. What race are you running? Who is your rival? And what does that mean for your team? And Scott's just not clear about it. I don't think because he was an evil person. I don't think because he had any kind of, nefarious motives. I think because he basically was a fairly insecure man. who was from the Royal Navy, and we did things in a very naval way, and we, you know, we respect hierarchy, and so, you know, you have the enlisted men are the enlisted men, and the scientists are the scientists, and there the twain shall meet. Amundsen was a democratic operation. Everyone that was heading for the pole was in it to head, get them to the pole first. Scott's operation has much more factions and much more uncertainty because the leader isn't clear. And the leader is in a sense, creating or perpetuating factions among the team. So they set off for the pole 2 weeks after Amundsen. Well, that gives them 2 weeks of potentially worse weather because we're getting closer to winter and further into summer. But nevertheless, the ponies immediately flounder. The men don't. Scott doesn't really trust dogs, and he doesn't want to be cruel to the dogs, so he doesn't want to push them. Well, this is no place to have dogs if you want pets. They're not there for pets, right? And the ponies start immediately floundering and eventually die. The sledges give up the ghost. And so, you know, within, before they get to the halfway point to the pole, the men are actually man-hauling all the sledges. There are a number of men that start out. Scott, like Amundsen, will come to a point more than halfway there when he will turn, when the polar team will go on and everyone else will peel back. And at that point with Scott, no one still knows whether they're on the polar team or not. So imagine you're a man on this. You hope to be picked, I guess, and you don't know what's going on. And when he finally comes to make the decision, he has originally said it will be four of us going. Scott,
this part is unbelievable.
Four of us going. Scott and his three companions. And he decides at the last minute, partly because he doesn't want to anger two men that are on the fringes, to take both. Well, they've cached food and managed stores for four. So they're already, you know, they're already kind of, if you will, with you know, a big handicap, a fatal handicap on their golf game heading for the pole because they don't have enough food. And because he didn't want to push the dogs too far in the advance parties, they haven't depoted very far south as an advance party. So that's why they only have two food stores on this long 500-mile trek, while Amundsen has seven. So pretty quickly, it becomes clear that they are, by the time they get to the pole and see the flag, great, you know, kind of, if you will, disillusionment, disappointment in all the men's diaries. One of them is injured. Right, they are probably most all of them suffering the early signs of scurvy because, unlike Amundsen, they're not eating that fresh meat. One of the things about killing the dogs was it gave you fresh meat, which is, turns out, a prophylactic against scurvy, right, caused by not getting probably enough vitamin C and some other things.
And Amundsen knew that?
Oh, Amundsen knew that. Oh, yeah. I mean, Shackleton knew it. That's why they killed so many penguins and seals on the Endurance expedition 4 years later.
Well, Scott's people are eating meat out of cans,
they're eating canned food, lots of canned food.
So they didn't kill the ponies and use them for food.
You know what? They ate the ponies, but that's not enough. The ponies died so early on, that doesn't really help them by the get to the pole. They don't have any fresh meat, right? And they're under-resourced in terms of literally the average calories they're consuming. They're consuming about as much as Amundsen was, but the Amundsen men aren't man-hauling. The Amundsen men are on skis, right? And the Amundsen men have plenty of food to keep that calorie count on the way back, which the Scott folks don't. So they get to the pole, great disillusionment, great depression. They have not done what Amundsen done and marked their path as clearly. So they didn't do any of the black flags and lots of stuff. They built cairns, snow cairns, right? Like a pile of snow. Think of your kid's snowman higher. And as they head back, they have trouble finding the depot. At the same time, they're all slowly starving. They are slowly starving. Two of them have injuries, both of which are becoming gangrene.
Oh.
And Scott himself is developing injuries. And so they're all debilitated emotionally and physically. Scott does not think, like Amundsen does, to actually travel during the night of the Antarctic summer because the sun's in your eyes heading north, blindingly so, on a completely white plateau or a completely white landscape. So Amundsen travels during the night, sleeps during the day. Scott does the reverse. They suffer from snow blindness. They have terrible trouble finding the multiple cairns on the southern side of the Antarctic Mountains and almost an impossible time racing for those two food depots on the other side. And so they know they're racing for their lives. Their diaries are filled with, we got to get to the depot today, right? But they're tired. They're man-hauling. And for the first part of the journey, they make good time with the wind at their back. And then, beginning about the end of January, they slow way, way down. And you know, one man dies, probably of starvation and psychosis and an injury. Titus Oates, a week or two later, walks out of the tent because he can't get himself up and walking. And the other three clearly clumber. Kind of clamber, trudge on. And then in early March, they get to within 10 miles of what they call a one-ton food depot, where it's the food depot that's, if you will, the most northern. If they get there, they'll get home. They're probably about 180 miles from home. And a blizzard, right, stops them in their tent. And they're too weak to go on. And so they were 11 miles from that depot. They literally lay down to die. And their diaries are like goodbye letters to the world. And so they die in their tent. They're found 8 months later, 9 months later, by some of Scott's party. And immediately he actually becomes a great martyred hero. His last lines are, for God's sake, look after our people. And yet, you know, I mean, you know, appreciate the cause for which he died, but you can't appreciate the reasons, right? Because it was bunglingly done in every step of the way. And his men were debilitated, not just physically, but emotionally along the way. They were confused. And he put almost literally no attention into energy management, I think probably because he was so insecure and holding his own card so close to his chest.
So you tell the story, I believe, in the Huffington Post,
yes,
Athena,
it's great.
Health.com. And the purpose is to tell these stories of the most dramatically different kinds of leadership and the consequences of preparation and engagement and all the kinds of things leaders should do and the consequences of what happens when leaders plan for nothing and essentially end up like Scott, not literally, but figuratively.
Absolutely. And, you know, in this age when we wonder what kind of impact we have, here's a perfect example, you know, in dramatic circumstances, a perfect example of how every small thing that a leader does, right, who he talks to on a given day, right, whether he allows a kind of simmering set of tensions among his team to grow, every little thing that a leader does has this great impact because all those men were taking their cues, trusting in each of these men with their lives. So lest you think you're not a leader and you don't have impact, read this story and both weep and laugh for the possibility and the tragedy of leadership, qua leadership.
Okay, I have a question that is probably a ridiculous one, but how did they see at night?
So it in the summer, on the southernmost part of the
stays
earth,
late.
It's the sun's basically doesn't set,
light,
right?
Late.
Just like
okay.
The sun does hardly rises
so
during the winter.
It would be almost 21 hours or 20
yeah,
hours.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
That's
okay,
how it is.
Two quick things, yep. Nancy. First of all, you've not been there, have you?
I've never been to South
Pole.
I need to
you
go
be the
because
Shackleton?
I'm not
you're
going.
The
after reading
you're
this.
One of the preeminent experts on Shackleton. You've now done
I know,
this
I need
great
to go.
Writing about Amundsen
I need
Scott.
To go.
Why have you you've been everywhere else? Why haven't you been there?
I've been everywhere else, but I need to go. No
okay.
question.
Okay. And secondly, just let's pick quickly one current example. Chris Christie from last week. You saw or heard or read about his hour and 47-minute press conference. You heard him say, I didn't meet with the woman who inspired this thing. I didn't need to hear what
you
she had to say.
You heard the text say we don't need to worry about the school kids that didn't get to school because they, you know, are those you know, opponent
Where does Chris
supporters?
Christie fall on the Amundsen-Scott spectrum?
So he falls probably a stand, you know, maybe two standard deviations toward Scott, right? At least judging by this instance. I don't care whether he never knew or not, right? It's a leader's, you know, it's a leader's responsibility, right, to own the buck. It stops right at your desk. So the fact that if he never talked to this official, she or he saw license, or he's involved, saw license to do this, says an enormous amount about the unspoken latitude and values that Christie imparted to his people. Come the hell on. You can't create traffic jams to pay back political opponents. That is wrong. That is wrong. That is wrong.
Amundsen would never have done that, would he?
Absolutely not. Because, see, here's the thing about Amundsen and Shackleton. Like, they took the responsibility for the men's lives that their power gave them, and they owned that. And that was an honorable and grave thing.
You know,
and they discharged it carefully.
You know, well, you are this expert on Shackleton. We've used his name 400 times. A lot of people may not. Just 30 seconds okay. about how his relationship to all this, because he didn't make it, even though he is right. legendary and beyond.
So for those of you that are new to the area of Antarctic exploration, its relevance today, the most famous of all these interesting, driven people, egomaniacs all, was Ernest Shackleton, an explorer who actually had been involved with Scott in the early 20th century on a failed expedition to discover the South Pole, and who later went back after Amundsen, after Scott, to try and be the first to walk across the pole using dogs. That didn't work too, but that's another story, and you can learn about that if you Google me, because I've written so much
Nancy
about it.
Nancy Kane, K-O-E-H-N.
Give me a plug. Yeah, and sorry. And in any event, the long and short is his ship is moored, is stuck in the ice right off the coast of Antarctica. It eventually goes down 8 months later. And for another year and a half, basically, his men are
Incredible.
Stuck on an iceberg, right, with tents and killing seals and penguins. And he swears the day the ship gets stuck, I'll bring them all home alive. And by God, he did.
Well, here's one of the greatest quotes of all time that you probably have heard and written, but I don't know if others have. It's from Sir Edmund Hillary. Yeah. The great line is, "For scientific discovery, give me Scott. For speed and efficiency of travel, give me Amundsen. But when disaster strikes and all hope is lost, get down on your knees and pray for Shackleton." How great is that?
So true.
Is that perfect? Yeah. What a great story, that's Nancy. Where do we read? AthenaHealth.gov?
So AthenaHealth.com has a leadership forum where this story is in two parts with all the lessons carefully enumerated.
It's great.
HuffPost has a tiny little summary of it. Just Google the story.
Yeah,
we love it.
But you want to read the whole thing. It is riveting. It's great, and it won't take long to read because you'll be flying through it so quickly. Nancy Kane joins us every Tuesday for Open Mic. She's an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her latest book is about the aforementioned Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, as always, great to see you.
See you soon.
Thank you for the privilege.
When we come back, Beverly Scott, the general manager of the MBTA, she's going to take your questions and our questions. That conversation coming up, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
The push to ban bullying is moving from schools to the workplace.
We're not saying that anybody who says, hey, you know, you're bullying me, that we should believe them or give that credence. But we are saying, if somebody says, hey, I'm being bullied, look at that. Take that seriously.
But critics say it's a case of good intentions gone way too. I'm reporter Adam Riley. That story this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
This program is on WGBH thanks to you and Cambridge Savings Bank, a proud member of the community for over 175 years, providing a full range of financial products for individuals, families, and businesses. Because legacy matters. CambridgeSavingsBank.com. And Bryant University, with 150 years of preparing students with the knowledge, skills, and qualities of character for success in a changing world. Information on undergraduate and graduate programs at Bryant.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Here with us in Studio 3 to take our questions and yours at 877-301-8970. You better get them in quickly is Beverly Scott. As you probably know, Beverly is the MBTA General Manager. Beverly, it's great to see you again.
It's a pleasure, always, and Happy New Year.
And
Happy
same
New
to you.
Year. Happy New Year to you too, Beverly Scott. Thanks for coming in. So a big story in the paper today about the state transportation officials. And by the way, we're going to take everybody's calls in a second. I should have said that before that. A couple of questions from us to you. Dealing with these long-time complaints over many years about discrimination at the MBTA involving minorities and women pay, hiring, promotions and stuff. So what's going on with that, Beverly Scott?
So let me give you the backdrop. Okay, the first thing I want to be very clear about is that has there been a significant amount of progress at the T and MassDOT through the years? There most certainly has. I mean, today we have 41% of our employees are minorities, and we have 24% are women. And that number in terms of managers is like 30 and 25%. So I set that, and I've been in this industry for 35 years, and I tell you the honest to God's truth, this ain't the T from 20, 25, 15 years ago. Okay, now having said that, however, are there things in terms of process, procedure, practice, okay, that quite candidly were challenged. I think we're kind of cutting edge here in terms of the transformation that took place because now we're one DOT, okay? So literally what the federal government came in and they said, the Department of Transportation, is that you guys need to, it wasn't looking at a particular complaint, if you will, to say, oh, you all have got, but in terms of process, practice, procedure, and particularly with us having done a merger of our civil rights function over the last couple of years, is that we needed to really take it down to nuts and bolts and be very, very clear of how does a bill become a law. If an individual does have an issue, how do they really wind up being able to file that and all that. So the other thing I'll say is that there is a number that's out there, the 750 complaints over a 3-year period of time, and those, and that's just not an accurate number, okay, of any kind of formal complaints that were filed at the organization.
You think there are fewer?
Oh, much fewer, okay, of formal complaints, okay. What we wound up doing in an effort, and I don't think we would have done it any differently. When we were asked to wind up providing documentation, we provided anything that we had received as even an inquiry on anything that was a civil rights matter. When it really came down to it, over that 3-year period of time, we had 37 complaints that had been filed at MCAD, which is the state agency. We had about 115, and I'm not happy about any complaint, but I just want to be real clear about this is not a runaway at 750 complaints over a 3-year period of time. We had about 115 that had been formal complaints that had been filed internally with our civil rights office. Now, I step back and I say this. Are we perfect? Absolutely not. Is this a what we challenge ourselves to in the area of civil rights is that we want to be just as excellent in terms of diversity and inclusivity at the MassDOT and the MBTA as we strive to be in every single other aspect of our operation. So it is a journey. I tell people all the time, it is a journey, and it's not a journey that you ever get to claim. I call it full success because your communities are always shaping and they're always moving. And at the end of the day, we should evaluate ourselves in two ways. One, that we are representative of the communities that we serve in all of their diversity. The other is that it becomes not a function of compliance, but really becomes just a part of the DNA of our organization, our community. And the other is that always at the foundation, I just say like this, I've always been, we got a lot of rules and a lot of laws, and I don't take anything away from them, but nothing beats just plain old, have I treated you in the same manner that I would have wanted to be treated, or I would have wanted my mother, my child, or whatever. To me, it don't get too complicated, okay?
Now, and by the way, you should say, you haven't said it about yourself, but I will say you've only been there 13 months, by
yes.
the way. These complaints and this whole federal investigation track a long period of time. One last thing about this, Beverly Scott, and then we do want to get to calls because there are a lot of them for you. Philip Gordon, who's a plaintiff's lawyer in one of the cases that claims discrimination here, says, is quoted in the Globe today, it's stunning that the only time the MBTA and MassDOT, and that's the Department of Transportation you've been referring to, will sit down at all to even consider fixing the system is when the federal government comes in and says, we'll pull your funding. Even then, it's kicking and screaming, woefully inadequate for the problems, still fails to take care of the past. What's your response to Gordon?
I would tell you that that's absolutely incorrect, okay? And that's just for the 13 months that I know I've been there. So, once again, I will come back and I will say to you, I know this industry and I know the T, and I will tell you it is a very different T than it has been. I have found the organization to be one that that cares, okay? Now, are there issues there? Certainly, as there are any place, okay? But and we have a leadership at the T, and I just look at things. I go in and I look at the table and who's at the table that I sit around, okay? And I will tell you that this is an organization that is very, very sensitive and very concerned. And we I absolutely do not agree at all with the gentleman's statement.
One last thing. There's some in this piece in the Globe today. They talk about some research that was done. I don't know if it was in the early part of the 2000s when they talked about the percentage of people who were people of color and leadership and that sort of thing. Where were we a decade ago in terms of people of color in position and women in positions of leadership at the T as compared to where we are now?
I would tell you that probably about half of where we are today. Okay. An area that for us, when I look at the current numbers, and this is once again, it is constantly a journey. But I will tell you that an area for us that there are still pockets where in terms of women and in terms of minorities that you do not have the kind of penetration that you'd like. And
81% of top jobs in 2002, I'm sorry to interrupt you, were held by white men. What percentage now would you say?
Now I would tell you that that number is about 70.
70.
It's about 70.
One last thing before we get to the calls, because I know people want to talk to you. Yeah, Joan Vinaki wrote a very complimentary piece that she quoted from the Globe. She quoted you as saying you're going to, break a few eggs or...
Crack a few eggs. To make an omelet.
When you took over. And she contends that you cracked more than a few eggs. When the decision was made, where your boss, Rich Davey, who spends a lot of time with us, recused himself because of his historical employment. And you picked not the politically connected entity to continue being in charge of commuter rail, but this overseas company. Tell briefly, if you can, so we can get to the calls, what went into that decision-making and why was the decision not to continue with what had been?
Literally, we had two world-class teams, and I'll tell you, both of the world-class teams include significant international content. It's there are very few. In fact, there's really it would be very difficult to find a company that's truly just a U.S. company that would be able. This is the largest commuter rail outsource contract in the United States. Okay, so let me just give you the perspective of the T. Okay, as far as I was concerned, that it was all about the process, making sure that it was transparent, level playing field, both to good companies, and to make sure that there was a process that permitted there to be a level playing field, evaluated fairly, and quite candidly, it would not have mattered to me personally out of that process which of the teams it would have been. Both of them are world-class organizations.
How much pressure was there on you? We mentioned
Absolutely
Rich Davey
not a bit.
Worked for the existing company. Doug Rubin, who was a big-time consultant to Deval Patrick, who is your ultimate, well, he's technically your boss, but whatever he is, he's the governor of the Commonwealth. Doug Rubin was one of the lobbyists for this. You have a smile on your face. How much pressure was there? You don't even know who he is?
I just know a name. Okay,
perfect.
Don't say it, so I don't even know.
So the answer is there was no outside? Is that what
there
you're saying?
Was, I am telling you, absolutely not. Okay, absolutely not. Okay, and
believe me,
so
he knows your name, Beverly Scott.
So why'd you pick the company that was from out of the country and not the local?
Because the technically, and I didn't actually know and wasn't supposed to until the night of December 2nd. And after all the best and final evaluation had been done, these came in on August the 9th. We had the team. I asked them for military silence and a lockdown. And quite candidly, we had it up until about the last week and a half. It was a best value procurement. And that meant that it was on operations and management and on the cost. And in each instance, on both the operations and management across 11 areas, the team was the Keolis team was rated good as opposed to acceptable, which meant that they covered all the four corners. And then on the cost, they came in with the superior cost. It was a $254 million difference on the cost, which translates on an annual basis over the 12-year period anywhere from about $15 million to about $25 million a year difference. So I called it a 1+1=2, which was operations and management across all of the key areas. They were the superior as well as on the cost. And then I went through with all of the teams, read through. I've actually read the proposals, but I went through with all of the teams and went through it with them. And I was very comfortable to make the recommendation unequivocally to make that award.
There's a rumor that you hired a food taster after making the decision. Is there any truth to that, Beverly?
No, there is
okay,
no
I just
food
want to,
taster.
I just want to clarify. Let's take some calls for Beverly Scott, the GM of the MBTA, 877-301-8970. Let's start in JP with George. Hi, George.
Hi, this is George Z. I'm one of the biggest and first fans of Beverly Scott. I'm the swan boat dad to Jim and Marjorie.
Hey there, George.
Hi, George.
George, it's not a great connection, so I hate that you should get to your question if you can. I'm sorry.
Hello, George.
It's okay.
Hi.
Hello.
Okay, can you talk about Track 66 and the E-Line extension to the Latin Quarter?
No, I can't, okay?
What is Track 66 and the E-Line extension to the Latin
to the
Quarter,
Latin
Beverly
Quarter.
Scott? What's he talking about?
Talking about the possibility of doing some further extension in terms of our service. And at this point in time, we don't have any plans to do so. And I think I met you. Did I meet you on the Cape Flyer?
Yes, you did.
I did. And our team has been sitting up, and I know you've been. I have definitely passed it along. It's not that we're not thinking that at some future world when we all get into visioning, but at this point in time, as we said, it really hadn't been put in on any other plan.
George, thanks so much for the call. Yes, we know that there's this $12 billion capital investment that the governor and your boss, Rich Davey, proposed in terms of transportation things. It's unclear if all that'll happen, depending on what happens with this gas tax inflation repeal thing. What expansion is going to happen regardless of what happens in these capital efforts. What's on the table right now, Beverly Scott?
The Green Line Extension Project absolutely is going to wind up taking place, which is going to wind up taking the Green Line. We'll have service Somerville, Medford. So that is definitely
That's the Assembly
gonna,
Square and all that
that's,
stuff?
That's definitely going to wind up taking mm-hmm. place. It gets us out. I mean, that's going to be great. The other one that we have that is South Coast Rail, okay, and there will South Coast Rail is definitely going to wind up getting that real catalyst, and there's going to be movement on South Coast Rail as a function of this.
And that goes from where to where?
Well, South Coast Rail ultimately is going to wind up getting down to New Bedford, Central Falls, and all that. So it's going to wind up taking a long time, okay? But that is definitely one that is, there's going to be some work that's going to be done on South Coast Rail. The other one that you're going to have is on South Station, okay? There is money that's been put into the way forward to wind up being able to get the South Station. It's critical for South Station that we wind up being able to add additional tracks, okay? Because otherwise you really cannot wind up doing further expansion in terms of commuter rail, and let's don't even talk about high-speed rail. So South Station is going to be, we have diesel multiple units, and this is a new type of service, and so we're very committed to wind up having, they're like a self-propelled, if you will, mm-hmm. Commuter rail coach, okay? And so we're very committed to wind up having DMUs introduced, and that will be out on the Fairmont line with maybe some possibilities, but definitely the Fairmont line. Chelsea, you're going to see an extension of the Silver Line over into Chelsea. So I would tell you that in terms of extensions, if you will, okay, though expanded service, okay, that are the big mega projects, those are the ones that are on the transit side that I would really focus on, okay? Now, the other thing that I have to say is that the biggest piece for us that wound up coming, which was appropriate, is state of good repair, okay? So for us, Orange and Red Line cars, being able, that procurement, we got that procurement right out on the street. That's like a little bit over 200 cars. We got that thing out on October the 22nd. As soon as everybody said, we're ready to roll, and that includes, which I find extremely exciting, a Make It in Massachusetts component. If we do not, that's almost $1 billion worth of rail cars. And I don't know about other people, but I'm very tired of going down outside of Philadelphia to wind up seeing final assembly of the rail cars that we have here from South Korea being done down there. There is no reason why almost every dollar that we can, we don't get a multiplier effect and really wind up being able to put some additional, really have some business development that winds up taking place here. So the Orange and Red Line cars, those were the first ones that we got out the hopper. Buses and bus replacement is extremely critical for us in terms of this, in terms of the program. Being able to stabilize, there really wasn't a lot of what you called operating money that wound up coming out of this because it was primarily capital. But being able, but what we did get out of it was for almost a 5-year period of time, the T is not going to be in the perennial fire, you know, oh my God, you know, we're going to have to 23% increases in fares and all that. Now, I don't want to say it's an inoculation for life because it's not, but we have been able to stabilize, thankfully, on the operating side. We'll still have some fare increases, but they will be very modest, okay? But there's not a lot in terms of big service. The other thing I want to...
When are fare increases going to happen?
We can do fare increases. We're expecting a fare increase in for what we'll have in July in 2015.
And when you say modest, what's the range?
We're looking at 5%. Actually, the way that the legislation went in, we actually had fare increases, as you know, that were as high as it was average 23%. So actually, the transportation funding legislation, as it came out, actually wound up capping us to not doing any more than an average of a 5, would wind up being a 5%. And so you'll see those as just a matter of policy. And rather than having anything that will be big, they'll be just kind of going along on a pretty steady clip.
Beverly Scott, we are buried in email and texts and other things. And I assume you will, if we give them all to you, if we don't,
absolutely,
you will respond to them. But I want to read, Rick from Waltham says, we were talking about the new contract on commuter rails. Keolis, how you pronounce it?
Keolis.
Keolis.
Right.
Does the agreement with the new commuter rail operator, Rick from Waltham, ask, have metrics for operational performance? He says the ad hoc tracks MBTA alerts for delays on Fitchburg and Worcester lines 10 to 20%. He knows weather is part of it, but hardware problems are part two. He quotes you saying the new contract sets a no-excuses expectation that the operator will run the trains on time. If they don't run the trains on time, what happens?
If they don't, now I'm going to tell you, I'm not about penalties because I want good service, okay? But what we wound up doing is that we totally strengthened. So if they don't, then we can, in fact, wind up, we'll do penalties. And let me tell you the changes that took place. Number one, the OTP is a 95% requirement provision.
On time.
We don't want excuses, okay? If, in fact, you wind up, we do not wind up having any offsets in this contract. So there were no incentives that were put in this contract. The other thing is that the excusable incidents, which today there's a whole list of things that are excusable. If there's a leaves on the track, if the there's that they are automatic excuses. There are no automatic excuses in this. What winds up happening is that there are absolutely no incentives. We had incentive provisions in the existing contract. So to tell you the honest to God's truth, in many years the incentives would offset the penalties. Okay, and so our point was absolutely, you're not making money on this. We absolutely want you to be focused in terms of service. You will get we're not saying that there cannot be times when the CSX out, but you don't. And the other difference is this. In the current contract, penalties were capped annually at $3 million. And this next one, we took that cap of the $3 million out. We wound up making it be up to 5% of what your profit could be, which put us up to at least about $12 million that we could get for penalties if we had to assess them.
Paul from Chelsea, you're on with Beverly Scott. She's the general manager of the T. Hey, Paul.
Hi, Dr. Scott.
Hi, Paul. How are you?
I'm pretty good. Could I ask you for more buses on the 116 and 117 from East Boston, Chelsea, Revere, because especially in the afternoon, because the drivers do a heroic job, but there's a drawbridge on that route, and it goes up a couple times a day, and it throws the schedule into helter-skelter land.
Do you know what? I know exactly what you're talking about because I've seen, and that 116 and the 117 are very, very heavily utilized, and your community really utilizes our service well. I will tell you that it is when I've got it down. Okay, that's what I'll tell you, and I know I can tell you the 116 and 117 when we do our service planning sits up very high in terms of a well utilized service. Okay, so I have it as a note.
Paul, thank you for your call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Gloucester. We're Liz.
Hi, Liz.
Hey, Liz.
Thanks for calling.
Hi. Beverly. I want to talk about North Station.
Okay.
I had two teenagers, and they took a class at Harvard University last summer, and they're going to take another one next summer. I was comfortable with them taking the commuter rail, but there's no bus that goes out of North Station. There's not a lot of choices of buses.
Okay.
The only people I really know that utilize the train on the North Shore are commuters. And I feel like I could take the train right, door to door into a Celtics game or a Bruins game right into North Station. But the last one leaves, I think, at 9:30. And I don't know if you've looked at that. It just seems like the northern lines, either to Newburyport or to Rockport, there's not enough service. And when you do get to North Station, there are not enough bus routes.
Liz, we got it. We're very short on time, so let's hear what Beverly Scott has to say.
Do you know what, Liz, and if you call me Beverly, I'm so happy. I'm putting my notes down. That's it. Liz, I'm putting my notes down. I can tell you that, and I really will. We will follow. I will really follow up. I know that everybody's point is, Bev, we want more service. We want more frequent service. And I forgot to say, and later night service, when I was talking about the new things that are
Amen.
Up, this new innovation that we're going to do with the late night service on Friday and Saturday night, which is honestly going to wind up being a lot of that's going to be offset by sponsorships. I think it's going to really just, I think the time for it is long overdue.
Universities, corporations, yeah, that's it. We only have 30 seconds left. Okay. Someone emailed and said, who is Sharon Banks and what does she have to do with you?
Oh, God.
Because I know You don't get compliments. You only get questions and critiques. Who is Sharon Banks, and what does it mean? Quickly, if you can.
I'm going to Washington tomorrow. I'm deeply honored. I'm receiving from National Transportation Research Board a humanitarian service award that is being bestowed for Sharon Banks. And the reason I'm sounding a little emotional, because I knew Sharon Banks. She died many years ago. She was the first woman to chair the National Academy of Science Transportation Research Board, and they have a National Humanitarian Service Award. They've given her name, and I am going to receive it tomorrow.
Congratulations, Beverly Scott.
Congratulations, and thanks for taking the time to come in with us, Beverly Scott, who, of course, is the general manager of the MBTA.
Can I interrupt you 1 second?
Yep.
Everybody who's on the phone, everybody who sent an email or tweeted us questions, everyone will go to Beverly Scott's office. All of you will get a response.
Please tune in tomorrow. We're going to be talking to the Globe's Brian McRoy. We're also going to be talking, because of the Supreme Court case involving clinic buffers, about inequities in women's health and other areas. I'm Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thanks for tuning in, and please tune in again tomorrow.